welcome to Sip for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. We've got a really great lineup today. Later in the episode, we'll be joined by Tim Seagrave from Manchester City Council with some thoughts and tips on capital strategy, as well as Paul Dossett from Grant Thornton to talk about lessons from the recent public interest reports. But first and foremost, hopefully you'll all be aware that SIPFA's annual conference, Public Finance Live, is coming up soon in July as a face-to-face event. Now, I don't know about all of you, but the big thing I've missed about conferences over the last year is the swag. I am starting to run out of pens. It's a nightmare. I need to stock up again, and conferences are fabulous for that. Speaking in all seriousness though, the programme is shaping up really nicely. We're going to be touching on some really interesting topical subjects as we move towards post-COVID recovery, including climate change, audit, inequality, and the future of the workplace. And for this week's episode, we've been joined by Times Radio presenter Asma Mir. Asma will be chairing day two of this year's event, but she has kindly agreed to join us to give us a sneak peek on her thoughts around the discussion topics that she'll be leading.
I'm here with award-winning broadcaster and journalist Asma Mir. Thank you so much for joining us on Sip to Speak today, Asma.
You're welcome.
So first and foremost, we're thrilled to have you chairing day two of our upcoming conference. But before we talk Public Finance Live and current events, would you mind giving our listeners a bit of info about you and your very interesting background?
Well, thank you for saying it's interesting. It never seems that interesting to me, but I am a journalist. I was totting it up almost 30 years. 1993 is when I started. I started as a journalist for Scottish Television in Glasgow. So that's almost 30 years. I was born in Glasgow. I went to university in Bristol, studied law, didn't fancy that. Seemed very, very, very difficult and a lot of hard work. I diverted to journalism, where I have stayed, and I've worked for various broadcasters, Scottish Television, ITV, Radio 5 Live, Radio 4, a little bit of LBC, and I am now at Times Radio. I started there last June, so not even a year there, but it's all going really well. It's all very exciting indeed.
That's really great to hear. So you've kindly agreed to be a speaker and chair at SIPFA's upcoming conference, Public Finance Live, on the 7th and 8th of July here in London. Now, this year's conference sessions focus on the ideas of place, planet, and profession. So since you'll be leading some of the sessions, we'd like to get your thoughts on each of these core themes. The first theme I'd like to discuss is place, looking at local issues and our communities in greater detail. So for me, the first issue that often comes to mind is inequality. As a journalist, what do you see as the most pressing issues linked to inequality in our communities? And maybe that's here in the UK, or maybe that's international as well.
I think, and we'll probably get to this, that coronavirus has laid bare what inequality actually means in this country. But before, even before coronavirus, you know, it was the same things. It was health, it was education, it was employment opportunities, and how inequality in your background, in your life circumstances, from when you're born really to when you go to school, and what's available to you and what is not, and who you know, and your network and your non-existent network, all these questions, all these issues have such a huge impact on you from such an early point in your life, and can of course have a huge impact on you for the rest of your life. There have been people, campaigners, who've been talking about this for decades. But I think coronavirus, like many things, really brought this into much sharper focus because, for example, we saw children not being able to learn because they didn't have computers at home, they didn't have internet, you know, their parents were having to get up early and print stuff off and kind of give it to them, or they just, you know, they had to go and beg or borrow laptops. So that's inequality right there, isn't it? Because my child was able to access her homework, as such as it is for a five-year-old, on a computer, whereas someone else in her class would have struggled to, and that's inequality, and that's unjust. So that's one of the inequalities that I think is just feels unconscionable, really, that shouldn't really be allowed to exist. The other inequality, of course, is health, not being able to access advice, or, you know, obviously the health service in this country is free at the point of use to anyone. But I think we've seen again the inequalities that there are in health again through coronavirus. We've seen people of certain ethnicities, people in certain jobs, certain public facing roles were more likely to develop serious illness or to even die because of coronavirus. Again, that is an inequality. You know, the health service needs to be more switched on to people's particular susceptibilities, and those communities need to be equipped to ask for additional help because they need it. And I suppose the other inequality, as I see it, is employment, which is linked quite often, but not always, to education, in that many people will say that certain jobs are not open to them, not because people say you can't do the job, but because they don't have the right qualifications, in inverted commas, or they don't know the right people, and therefore they never hear about these opportunities in the first place. And I think, you know, these are very basic, pivotal, they're like the cornerstones of your life, you know, health, education and employment. And I think there's not many of us really who can say that these inequalities do not persist in 2021.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point that you made. It's, we often think of inequality in terms of numbers, but it is, you know, it's individual lives. Do you get the sense that obviously the COVID-19 pandemic has made these inequalities worse? Do you get the sense that things will improve, hopefully, once the pandemic is behind us?
You know what? I would like to think so. I think the problem is right now we're very alive to all of this stuff. You know, the school stuff is still fresh in our minds. The health stuff is still, you know, coronavirus was a health issue, and the health inequalities that it uncovered, we're still seeing them every day. I would like to think that something has changed. It's just, I just don't know. All I can do is hope, like so many people, that a lot of the stuff that, you know, people like me, you know, I'm a journalist, I knew these things existed, but I think it was only when I saw it played out in front of my eyes that I really appreciated how difficult this was for certain groups in society, that they just were quite literally putting their lives on the line because of their physiology, because of the jobs that they were doing, and because they had less protection than someone like me. I mean, I did continue to go into work, but someone like me, middle class, privileged person who could have just continued to hide at home, to cocoon themselves. And many people who developed serious illness or died because of coronavirus could not do that because of the very nature of their jobs. You know, I just hope and pray that we don't forget that stuff. We don't forget those images. Again, like I say, all I can do is hope, hope and hope and hope. I saw something in the paper today, actually, which gave me a bit of hope. And this was a report in the Times about how pupils from, I'll say, less advantaged backgrounds are being offered practical training at school to become doctors, to try to get more, you know, different people in the medical profession. And this is just this great idea of just introducing pupils who would perhaps never think of a career in medicine or doing a degree in medicine, and kind of bringing it to them and saying, look, you know, this is what medicine's all about. I'm going to demystify it for you and kind of get it into their mindset from a very early age. Because, you know, let's face it, people who have parents who are in the medical profession who are doctors are more likely to become doctors. If you don't have that kind of family reference point and you don't know what the heck studying for medicine actually means, you are very unlikely to go into medicine, and therefore medicine and other careers just stay the way they are. And I think we all know now that a diverse workforce in journalism, in teaching, in whatever it might be, in medicine, can only be a good thing.
Right. And so in addition to inequality, another key topic that's become increasingly prevalent in the headlines over the past few years has been sustainability matters and also climate change. We'll be hosting a panel session at the conference on how governments and public sector organizations report their sustainability performance. Mm. That kind of fits into the second planet focus theme of Public Finance Live. Now, we often hear about corporate and private sector reporting and the role that businesses play in the fight against climate change. But what are your views on the government role in sustainability matters?
Well, this is interesting, really, because, you know, right now we're heading towards COP26, of course, in Glasgow. It's this idea of what should the targets be? Who imposes them? Should they be reported annually? Who sets these targets? How public should they be? We know what the government targets are, but is it right, I suppose, is the question, to impose climate change targets, emissions targets on public sector bodies? I mean, the argument, of course, is that we're all in this together. And unless all of us as individuals and within the public sector and the private sector do our bit, then we're not going to get there. So I suppose the question is whether that is the right thing to do. You know, should that be a kind of legally enforceable thing to say that, you know, you have to declare what your targets are and you have to meet them? Otherwise, there will be some kind of pushback on that. But I suppose, you know, that is the question that has yet to be answered, really.
Right, and we'll definitely be exploring that more at the conference. And lastly, Asma, we'll be having a session for delegates linked to the future of the workplace and how the new work from home normal is likely to impact the accounting profession. What are your thoughts on this new work dynamic that we're all living through at the moment? And more importantly, do you think it's here to stay?
Well, I do think it's here to stay. I don't think that this particular genie is going to be pushed back into the bottle. Neither should it be. I think it is a question of balance, as everything is, because clearly, if fewer people go into work full time, 5 days a week, that has an impact on local businesses, on that kind of city-based economy, the coffee shops, the sandwich shops, etc. That's something that we have to consider. It also has an impact on big employers' rents and overheads. Do they want to be paying massive rents on buildings that are half empty? But at the same time, we have to think about productivity. And that sounds like a horrible word, but there has always been, especially in this country anyway, I think, there's always been a bit of a suspicion about home working, that it's a bit of a cushy number, that people aren't really working. And I think I really do feel that that's kind of looking at the worst, suspecting the worst of people. And we just have to accept that this change that perhaps would have taken 20 or 30 years to happen has happened in 1 year. Because of coronavirus, people, I think, from what I've seen, are able to work effectively at home if they want to. There are, of course, many people, especially younger people, who still want that kind of office-based employment because, we've all had it, the older generation, middle-aged people like me, have had that and we've enjoyed it. So it's easy for us to say, oh, we can do without it. But I think we just have to embrace what's happening here. And it also goes into sustainability because, fewer people making fewer car journeys, as some of them were, into city centres, sitting in traffic jams, parking, and then sitting at a desk and then fighting their way through traffic for another hour or 2 hours in the evening. Was that necessarily a good thing? So I do think that working from home is here to stay, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I am currently working from home for domestic reasons, not for any other reasons. And to be honest with you, I would prefer to be at work, but I have a 5-year-old child and I have to look after her. I think it's just going to be a case of, I think employers are going to have to come around to it because I think there will be a huge demand for it. It's more flexible. It's the flexible working that we've always wanted. However, I don't think it's going to be 5 days a week. I think that, there will be, I suppose, some employers who want to perhaps limit it to 2 or 3 days a week. And how it affects the accounting sector, it will affect all sectors differently depending on how they work and on how much technological nous they have, I suppose, really. It's going to be different for all different types of sectors. I mean, the broadcast industry, which I work in, is actually surprisingly well geared up to it. And I think that's just an example of a sector that people said, well, you can't do that. You cannot have two people presenting a show who are not in the same room.
Right.
But we've proved that you can. And we're not the only people. There's plenty of people who've done it because it's born out of necessity and it can be done. So I think, in all sectors, if people have said, well, you can't do that, can't do that, I think you'll find that you can to a certain degree.
Very interesting thoughts, Asma. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you at the conference.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Asma for joining us this week. New speakers are being confirmed for conference all the time, so I've included a link to the programme in the description below. Snap up those tickets if you haven't done so already. Joining us next is Tim Seagrave with his thoughts on capital strategy. I'm here with Tim Seagrave, Group Finance Lead for Capital and Treasury Management at Manchester City Council. Thank you very much, Tim, for joining us today.
Hi.
Just for the start of the pretend then, could you tell our listeners a little bit about you, your background, how you got to where you are, and what your role entails?
Absolutely. So my current role as the Group Finance Lead is to manage the capital programme for the council in terms of the financials, particularly the funding side. So we're responsible for monitoring the projects that have got approval and are underway, but also for providing financial input into new projects and the business cases associated with them. I'm also responsible for managing the council's investments and debt book as well. I've been with the council for, gosh, far too long, probably about 11 years now. Prior to that, I was at Newcastle City Council, so I've skipped from one core city to another. And I did the vast majority of my CIFA training when I was at Newcastle.
Great. Thank you, Tim. So Tim has kindly joined us today to talk about capital off the back of SIPFA having recently published some new guidance around capital strategies. SIPFA's new guidance on capital strategies outlines that when it's done well, it adds significant value, not only to the successful management of an organisation, but more importantly, to the future success and well-being of the population, stakeholders, and the wider area that it serves. So what impact do you feel that a solid capital strategy has on people and services at the ground level?
I think it can be really, really significant. When you look at what capital strategy is aiming to do, it's aiming to provide that forward view. Where does the organization feel that investment will be required? What's important to the organization? What will it have to deliver? What is it looking to others to deliver? And that sort of gives a pathway into how services see themselves progressing. So there's a real opportunity there, one, for stakeholders to be involved, for services to speak to community groups and residents and businesses to look at where there might be issues that need to be resolved, but also to look at your future investment in a different way. So, for example, at Manchester, yes, we look at the finances, but we also look at place. What does our investment strategy do for our neighbourhoods? And what does a sense of place mean for each of our individual neighbourhoods? But it also gives us an opportunity to look at how children's services are going to be conducted in the future. Also to look at how the council's assets are used. So clearly a big part of our investment strategy is around investing in our own assets, either to keep them fit for purpose, but also to look at changing their use. So again, it provides that forward view. What does the future council look like and how can investment support that? It's challenging to do. Naturally, it is. We're in a very dynamic environment. We've been that way since probably 2010 when austerity first hit. You know, the resource base year to year can change. COVID has had an impact in that way as well. But if it's done right, that forward view can have quite a profound effect on both the services that we provide and therefore the businesses and residents that are using.
So how do you feel that finance professionals can get their whole organisation on board with the development of good capital strategy and avoid it being seen as a requirement or tick box exercise?
One word, listen. I've banged this drum within the City Council a lot. It's not a finance document. It's finance led, absolutely it is, because of where it comes from through SIPFA. And naturally, those people tasked with looking at the financial implications of future investment will be interested. But it's a global document for the organisation. What we've tried to do at Manchester is use the strategy to, yes, top and tail with the finances. What do we think the existing program is going to do financially in terms of both assets on the balance sheet but also funding it, and what capacity do we think we've got for future investment? But in terms of what that future investment looks like and what services think they might need or the risks that they're managing at the moment that they think investment could help with, that's a listening exercise. That's going out and speaking to service leads, to project officers, and having those discussions beyond what are you doing now? What does the next 2, 3, 4 years look like? So our strategy is quite strange and it's by no means perfect, but we talk about the existing programme almost as a restatement. That's not where we want members to really focus their attention in terms of the strategy, nor is it really where we want members of the public to focus their attention. What we're really wanting them to look at is we give a forecast pipeline of the activity we expect to come forward in the next 2, 3, 4 years with an explanation as to why that particular investment is important. And in some cases, it's contingent. It might be that if this thing happens, then we might need to invest here if there's market failure, for example. But predominantly, it's about that service change. How do services see themselves operating in 2, 3 years' time? And how can we invest to support that change? And what benefit does that bring to residents and businesses? So it's taken a lot of hard work to bring people on board. We've made a lot of changes in the background around governance processes to make sure that services not just have a voice, but have an ability to provide that information and steer their own investment. And the payoff of that is you get that engagement. And our role within finance is to listen and say, yes, there's going to be a strategy, but we need your views and your information to be able to feed into that for it to be a sensible approach and for it to be useful and meaningful for guiding future policy.
So is my understanding right that Manchester has around a £1.4 billion capital programme for the next 3 years, somewhere in that region?
Yes, it's a bit lower now because obviously we've skipped over a financial year. But yes, since that figure was published, yes, we're about a billion now, yeah.
Okay, so as part of the guidance, our main challenge to local authorities was to be ambitious, creative, inquisitive, sensitive and risk aware. So within that kind of envelope that we're talking about for your capital programme, what work is going on in your authority to meet that challenge?
Manchester's got a very long history of change and regeneration across the city. So we've got the airport in the south of the city, where the use of that site has changed significantly since the airport was established in the middle of the last century. And obviously we have the Commonwealth Games turn of the century, which for anyone who knew Manchester kind of in the 1980s and 1990s and comes to the city now, particularly if they visit the east side of the city, the change is profound. So we have a history, we have the ambition, we have the desire to keep changing and to look at how neighbourhoods change. A significant investment in highways, acknowledging the role that highways can play, not just in terms of growth within the city centre, but also routes in and out of the city centre. So there's a lot of investment in footpaths and cycleways and looking to really push that modal change that is so, so important in terms of the climate emergency that we've declared. Beyond that, we've got investment in two city fringe areas, so the Eastern Gateway to the city and the Northern Gateway. So geographically, Manchester is a quite tall and thin authority nestled in the middle of Greater Manchester councils. It's a very split authority in terms of north and south. To the north of the city centre in particular, there's a lot of former industrial use land. And what we're looking to do through a JV partnership is develop the infrastructure in that land to allow for housing development. So there's government money coming in to deliver gasworks, electricity, water that just hasn't existed on these sites because they've not been used for that purpose for a long, long time. And similarly to the east, we've got the Commonwealth Games investment, which has now become the broader Etihad campus around Manchester City Stadium. That's taken a huge amount of effort by the council and the partners to develop. There's the piece of work then to look at the transformation of the edge of the city centre to that previous regeneration, which is our Eastern Gateway. And again, there's a lot of informal industrial sites that will need remediation. And the ambition there is to create a new office district in the Eastern Gateway that will be some kind of zero carbon exemplar. And in the north, it's housing and homes. We absolutely recognise the desire to have home ownership within the city and to bring in investment that will allow us to extend sort of the city centre north a little bit, but also connect it to the neighbourhoods that already exist. We've also got the redevelopment of our town hall building, which is a listed Victorian building which hasn't had any significant capital investment in it since it was built. It's an astonishing building. It is a very, very complex project, but it's the centrepiece, the civic centrepiece for the city. So it's absolutely important that we secure that future use. And similarly, we've got the build of a factory cultural facility in the city centre, which is part art council funded, part city council funded, which will be a permanent home for the Manchester International Festival, which has been hugely popular. We've then got the kind of capital investment you'd expect for city council, investment in leisure facilities, in schools, in neighbourhoods, to make sure that we're providing the services that our residents in particular need. And also a lot of investment in carbon saving measures. So we're looking at introducing energy efficient buildings into the council's corporate estate. We have made carbon one of the central themes of our capital approval process. You have to look at what your project can do in terms of carbon savings for it to get any sort of approval. And then finally, we've got quite a significant investment in our ICT infrastructure, recognizing that what we do and how we do it is fundamentally changing, even pre-COVID, but particularly since COVID. You know, a lot more of us are working from home. That puts very particular demands and stresses on your ICT infrastructure. It's a very broad programme. It's a very diverse programme. There's a significant number of quite large projects and quite large schemes. And then we've got another large number of smaller schemes that are just as important in terms of service provision. They just don't necessarily have the scale. So it's fascinating to work on. It's a part of my job that I really enjoy.
So the scale and breadth of that, I take your point, it sounds fascinating and really, really kind of exciting to work on. But I imagine that's a double-edged sword in the sense that the breadth and the diversity of the programme brings with it its own challenges. So what would you describe as some of the key challenges around those capital ambitions that you just described?
Funding is a key challenge. I just get a reputation for saying no every time anyone asks for any money. But it's really difficult when you've got that level of ambition to make sure that we can achieve what we want to achieve. The impact that COVID's had in terms of the revenue budget and our ability to fund the future investment is obviously really in our minds at the moment. We're very focused on what are our key priorities, what are the things we absolutely have to deliver, and where can we bring in other funding sources? Where are the other types of investment that we could perhaps bring to bear that will allow us to achieve something similar? The other challenges are around some very specific bits of the programme. So particularly in ICT, for example, a lot of cloud-based solutions are now coming forward. So that's not capital investment, it's revenue. So how do you manage that? Because that places demand on the revenue budget. And also with the green agenda, how we can invest in green energy, for example, in a way that is compliant with the PWRB rules that have recently been issued, and obviously with the potential code and the Treasury Management Code as well. And the other challenge is just relationship building and trust. It's a very dynamic environment, and it's really important to me that both for me and my team that we develop those strong relationships with services so that we can follow them as their services change, as the challenges that they face change that we can support them in. And I think it's a really important part of the role. Capital investment is a quite a unique part of the broader financial management landscape, and being able to look at it from a global perspective and look at an overarching strategy rather than dealing with everything piecemeal is, I think, a really important part of our approach.
Brilliant. Thank you, Tim. I think there's some really interesting kind of learning points for the wider sector there. And I think there's plenty that our listeners will be able to take away from that. And it sounds absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much for taking the time out to speak to me today. You're listening to Sip the Speech, and that was Tim Seagrave from Manchester City Council. Finally today, we have Paul Dossett from Grant Thornton. Coverage of the recent public interest report has been circulating widely for some time now, and Paul has joined us to explore some of the lessons learned. I'm here with Paul Dossett from Grant Thornton. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Paul.
Good morning, Ashley, and good to join you.
Absolutely lovely day for it. Kind of unfortunate to be in the office.
Indeed.
Before we kick off talking a little bit about the recent public interest reports, for our listeners, well, I doubt they don't know GT, but if you could tell them a bit about yourself, your role, and what you do with Grant Thornton.
Yeah, so my name is Paul Dossett. I'm a partner at Grant Thornton, and I'm the head of local government. My principal work is in the audit of local authorities, although obviously we do a lot of work on advising local authorities as well. We audit 40% of all local authorities, and we provide advice to another sort of segment on top of that. So we work comfortably with over 50% of all local authorities. So we have quite a wide range of perspective of local government here at Grant Thornton.
Great, thank you. So Paul has kindly joined us today to talk about the recent public interest reports. And of course, Grant Thornton recently led on some fairly high profile reports recently. While we won't go into the detail on individual authorities, you did publish a really interesting report on lessons learned from the public interest reports, and our listeners will be able to find details about that in the description below. So my question today will largely be led by those lessons that you identified. So the report stated there are a number of lessons to be learned and that these can be broken down into three key areas, and it would be great to kind of go through those in turn. Firstly, you talk about the context of local government in a COVID-19 world. I write in thinking that this was largely about the sort of financial sustainability of local authorities. I mean, no doubt our listeners will be familiar with the topic, but please do kind of talk me through how you see COVID having impacted on what is a very live issue and has been for some time.
Yes. So I think the way we looked at COVID was that, I mean, obviously there are many, many challenges with COVID and dealing with the local community. And then I think our report sets out the fact that we think local government has done an excellent job in addressing some of those challenges, despite some of the challenges in the wider relationship with central government agencies. But I think what it did do was sort of crystallised some of the underlying financial weaknesses in some authorities, because whilst it is fair to say that government support for the 2021 budget for local authorities has been pretty good, and for many, in fact, the majority of local authorities has resulted in either a break even or indeed a surplus position, it has exposed some whose underlying weaknesses were already always there, but in fact have sort of come to the fore more rapidly. And actually, it's also exposed some of the wider challenges in long-term financial sustainability for local government, because we obviously have seen things like adult social care, children's impacted by COVID in ways that will come out going forward rather than necessarily at the time. And the adult social care challenge has not really been grasped, I don't think, by government. It's been sort of pushed down the road a bit, and we're still stuck with the same methodology of trying to finance it, which nobody's really happy with. And we are an aging population. That will just continue. And of course, I think on children's mental health, early data from some authorities has shown that that's going to be a long-term issue, partly driven by COVID, but partly other factors. And again, the cost of that for local authorities is going to be quite extreme. And I think we're then in a position where some of the government's plans about fair funding, business rates reform, those type of things have almost become, I wouldn't say redundant, but they're sort of parked for a bit, because in reality, government only has the space really at this juncture. And I think that's understandable to address the short term. And that's what it has been doing. So the funding for 21-22 will probably work out reasonably for most authorities. And then we've got to play forward for 22-23 and beyond. But of course, it doesn't look like that much will happen in that, other than perhaps a three-year settlement based on the current criteria, which means things like fair funded business rate reform are going to be stuck, a bit like the social care reform piece as well. So you're going to face a medium-term scenario where local authorities who have financial weaknesses are going to be quite exposed, and the exposure will be increased in those authorities whose economies are not able to recover quickly post-COVID because of the reliance that the council will have on business rates and council tax growth. And if those economies don't recover, the council's position is going to be weakened. The government obviously has its levelling up agenda and the towns fund and things like that, which all in isolation will provide support to particular places, but don't necessarily address long-term structural weaknesses in local economies.
So you touched there around some of the structural issues, and one of the things that your report did point out is issues around governance and culture. It mentioned that some authorities, obviously, well, all authorities have their scrutiny committees and their council meetings in place, but that these seem more like theatrics than a genuine effort to examine the work of the council. So what do you see as the main issues around sort of the quality of scrutiny in local government?
I mean, there's different models of governance. But in terms of scrutiny, I look at scrutiny in two bits, really. The scrutiny work of the scrutiny committee and the work of the audit committee. I think they're both important. I think what has happened in a number of authorities is that these bodies don't quite have the teeth they really ought to, because scrutiny is a fundamental part of democracy and how democratic organisations work. Scrutiny should be in a position where the council policy and the council plans are properly challenged by members of all parties and suggestions for improvement put forward. I mean, that's what should happen. I think it's fair to say, particularly in some of the councils where public interest reports were issued, but I think in others scrutiny is not always as robust as it should be. Partly that's because some of the politicians on the scrutiny committee are playing for the home team in terms of the who controls that particular council, and partly because some of the opposition politicians, however strong their scrutiny is, are ignored because they're opposition politicians, not because they haven't made a good point. And similarly, if you look at the audit committees, challenge with audit committees is perhaps about sometimes the quality of the members. And we see some very, very weak audit committees where that challenge and that scrutiny is just not there. Some of that's partly political, but much of it is just local authorities have a range of quality members. So generally speaking, some of the higher quality ones are in the cabinet and some of the lower quality ones are not in the cabinet. And training can be variable. I go to a lot of audit committee meetings. Some are pretty good and challenge well and ask good questions, and some are very weak and don't challenge at all and are almost just a process that people go through. And we literally have that spectrum in local government.
So in line with that, do you think there's room for skills development for members who are part of audit committees then, or is this more of a political issue?
Politics is always there, but I think it is a skills development thing. If you look at, compare that to the NHS, when they have an audit committee, in the majority of cases, it's quite strong, because a lot of those people have come from backgrounds where they're used to, either business backgrounds or charity backgrounds or whatever, and they're used to that sort of function of an audit committee. They can be quite good. Local government's a different model, but skills and training and consistency. One of the problems we see sometimes with audit committees is that you can get some quite good members on them, and they suddenly disappear off, as if it's the sort of thing that anyone could just be dropped in and be good at. If internal audit have said there's 10 high priority recommendations on adult social care, for example, I ought to be pretty unhappy about that if I'm an audit committee member, and asking what management are going to do about it. Again, some local authorities do that, but not enough, and therefore the audit committee is not effective enough in making sure that these weaknesses are dealt with. And similarly, when you look at external audit reports are quite important for audit committees. And if the external auditor is saying there is a problem here, it is not something to be ignored or brushed under the carpet. It is something that the audit committee should be getting exercised about and expecting management to provide answers. And I don't think that happens as consistently as it once did. And there are all sorts of reasons for that, partly because the role of the auditor has been a bit, not consciously downgraded, but since the abolition of the audit commission, it's been a more low profile thing. Part of that has meant that the wider members in councils haven't been able to engage with the external auditor in the way that they once did. There was a time when the external auditor engaged with full counsel to run through the annual audit letter. The National Audit Office's new code of practice has, I think, really helped in terms of reviving the role of audit, especially in terms of governance. So probably later this year and early next year, councils will be getting quite a comprehensive assessment of their financial sustainability, their governance arrangements, and their arrangements for economy, efficiency and effectiveness. I'm hopeful that will re-engage the wider members with the auditor and provide a more robust early warning system where there are problems, because one of the things we'd be looking to do is to present that report to full council so that every single member, nobody can say I didn't know, because you were told you had a big report that set it out clearly. These were the issues the council were facing. So everyone's briefed and therefore everyone can engage with the issues.
Previously you touched on, I suppose, the willingness of leadership to listen to scrutiny. Mm. So the report made quite a lot of reference to culture, leadership, listening. So in your opinion, what makes for effective leadership in this respect?
Clearly, parties will elect as their leader the person they feel will be the most effective at engaging with voters and getting things done. And clearly, there are a whole range of leadership skills that a leader of a council needs. But the other one I think is really important is the ability to listen, and the ability to listen not just to, you know, your own very close associates and advisors, but to council members. One of the things that distinguishes councillors from MPs or from any other form of democratic process is their closeness to the ground and their closeness to their local residents. And I think these are people that should be listened to by leadership, one as individual councillors, but actually just as members of various committees. And I think listening to the views of others about your proposals and the perspective of others about your proposals is really important. Now, I'm sure lots of leaders would say that they do that, and I'm sure some of them do. The reports we issued really reflected the fact that that engagement with other politicians in the council that weren't close associates of leaders was not what it should have been. And I think that's also about working with officers as well. You have a troika of three really important officers: the chief executive, the section 151 officer, and the monitoring officer. And these are people there whose job it is to give you advice to keep you on the straight and narrow. When they give you the advice, they really should be listened to. These are people that spent, in most cases, spent their entire career in local government or wider public service, and their experience is worth listening to. For example, if you just take the financial, the section 151 role, on the one hand, they've got to manage the revenue position and the financial sustainability of the authority from a revenue point of view. On the other hand, they've got to have a really strong capital perspective and what are the long-term financial implications of a particular project. So it's a really wide range of skills. If my section 151 officer says to me, I don't like the direction of travel here, they're not to be ignored. They ought to be engaged. The leader can quite rightly set out the policy objectives and what they're trying to achieve. And the section 151 can give advice on, it won't work very well in the way you want to do it because it's financially reckless. But if you did it in a different way, we could get to the same outcome. I just don't think there has been enough of that in some authorities.
Okay, so I suppose to kind of wrap up then, I mean, the conclusions make for slightly bleak reading in many ways. And obviously you point out that some of the issues that you've identified are not potentially as rare as we'd like to think they are. Your report identified some early signs of governance failings. Can you talk our listeners through what they should be looking out for? And crucially, the key question is kind of what's to be done about it? How can improvements be made?
I think early signs of governance failings come in a number of guises. I mean, first of all, if internal audit give you a clean bill of health and they're very clear that they've been able to do their work unobstructed, that's a really positive start. But of course, if internal audit are writing critical reports with lots of red recommendations, in isolation, you might think, well, that's only one report. Those are the issues that need to be stamped on quickly. So I think that's part of it. External audit will tend to raise issues that are about financial sustainability or governance failings or perceived governance failings. Again, things will tend to build up. External auditors don't tend to be particularly premature in terms of reaching conclusions. They do tend to mull over things. You might get a scenario where, for example, the council's has decided that way forward is to set up lots of companies. The external auditor will often, these days, given our focus, will be saying things, have you taken account of the lessons of XYZ and taken that into your planning? If you just say, well, I'm not interested in what you think, I'm just going to do it this way, that's an early warning sign. Council companies that don't pay their dividends on time or don't pay a dividend, that's a warning sign. You've got these indicators, many of which are financial, but some of which are cultural, which are, I would put down to things like the opposition are raising questions about a new venture, and they're raising questions that are not political, but the questions are just about governance and control, sustainability. These are warning signs, because actually, whilst some politicians will think the opposition are just being difficult, actually there are good warning signs about governance. If they raise a question that talks about budgetary control, decision making, delivery of objectives, these are really important warning signs for, about governance, and think leadership should take those on board and listen to those, because it's really important. So I think there are lots of little triggers, but really it's about stepping back and realizing a multi-million, in some cases billion pound authority is a really complex beast. The governance framework surrounding it needs to be well resourced, well focused, is there to protect and ensure that the local authority can deliver services to its public in a sustainable long-term way without having any of these disastrous public interest reports.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Paul. I think that about wraps us up, and that's been incredibly insightful. And we hope to welcome you back to the podcast again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Paul and to all of our speakers for joining us this episode. That about wraps us up for this episode, and we'll see you again next time.